If they don't think you believe it, they never will. His strategy of deferring his opener until the start of the defense's case would now pay dividends. He would begin the day and his case by delivering to the jury a statement that didn't have to be true, that could be as outlandish as anything ever heard in the courtroom. As long as he kept the jury riding along, nothing else really mattered. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, good morning. Today begins a new phase of the trial, the defense phase. This is when we start to tell you our side of the story, and believe me, we have another side to almost everything the prosecution has offered you over the past 3 days. I'm not going to take a lot of your time here because I am very eager, and Jason Jessup is very eager, to get to the evidence that the prosecution has either failed to find or chosen not to present to you. It doesn't matter which at this point. The only things that matter are that you hear it and that it allows you to see the full picture of what transpired on Windsor Boulevard on February 16th, 1986. I urge you to listen closely, to watch closely. If you do that, you will see the truth emerge. I looked over at the legal pad on which Maggie had been doodling while Royce spoke. In large letters she had written, "Windbag." I thought, she hasn't seen anything yet. "This case," Royce continued, "is about one thing, a family's darkest secrets. You got only a glimpse of them during the prosecution's presentation. You got the tip of the iceberg from the prosecution. But today, you will get the whole iceberg. Today, you will get the cold, hard truth. That being that Jason Jessup is the true victim here today. The victim of a family's desire to hide their darkest secret." Maggie leaned toward me and whispered, "Brace yourself." I nodded. I knew exactly where we were going. "This trial is about a monster who killed a child. A monster who defiled one young girl and was going to move on to the next when something went wrong and he killed that child. This trial is about the family that was so fearful of that monster that they went along with the plan to cover up the crime and point the finger elsewhere, at an innocent man." Royce pointed righteously at Jessup as he said this last line. Maggie shook her head in disgust, a calculated move for the jury. "Jason, would you please stand up?" Royce said. His client did as instructed, and turned fully to the jury, his eyes boldly scanning from face to face, not flinching or looking away. "Jason Jessup is an innocent man," Royce said with the requisite outrage in his voice. "He was the fall guy. An innocent man caught in an impromptu plan to cover up the worst kind of crime, the taking of a child's life." Jessup sat down, and Royce paused, so his words would burn into every juror's conscience. It was highly theatrical and planned that way. "There are two victims here," he finally said. "Melissa Landy is a victim. She lost her life. Jason Jessup is also a victim because they are trying to take his life. The family conspired against him, and then the police followed their lead. They ignored the evidence and planted their own. And now, after 24 years, after witnesses are gone and memories have dimmed, they've come calling for him." Royce cast his head down, as if tremendously burdened by the truth. I knew he would now wrap things up. "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we are here for only one reason, to seek the truth. Before the end of this day, you will know the truth about Windsor Boulevard. You will know that Jason Jessup is an innocent man." Royce paused again, then thanked the jury and moved back to his seat. In what I was sure was a well-rehearsed moment, Jessup put his arm around his lawyer's shoulders, gave him a squeeze, and thanked him. But the judge gave Royce little time to savor the moment or the slick delivery of his opening statement. She told him to call his first witness. I turned in my seat and saw Bosch standing in the back of the courtroom. He gave me the nod. I had sent him to get Sarah Ann Gleason from the hotel as soon as Royce had informed me upon arriving at court that she would be his first witness. "The defense calls Sarah Ann Gleason to the stand," Royce said, putting the accent on defense in a way that suggested this was an unexpected turnabout. Bosch stepped out of the courtroom and quickly returned with Gleason. He walked her down the aisle and through the gate. She went the rest of the way on her own. She again was dressed for court informally, wearing a white peasant blouse and a pair of jeans. Gleason was reminded by the judge that she was still under oath and turned over to Royce. This time, when he went to the lectern, he carried a thick file and a legal pad. Probably most of it, the file at least, was just an attempt to intimidate Gleason, to make her think he had a big fat file on everything she had ever done wrong in life. "Good morning, Miss Gleason."
"Good morning."
"Now, you testified yesterday that you were the victim of sexual abuse at the hands of your stepfather, Kensington Landy. Is that correct?"
"Yes."
With the first word of her testimony, I detected trepidation. She hadn't been allowed to hear Royce's opening statement, but we had prepared Gleason for the way we thought the defense case would go. She was exhibiting fear already, and this never played well with the jury. There was little Maggie and I could do. Sarah was up there, on her own.
"At what point in your life did this abuse start?"
"When I was 12."
"And it ended when?"
"When I was 13, right after my sister's death."
"I notice you didn't call it your sister's murder. You called it her death. Is there a reason for that?"
"I'm not sure what you mean."
"Well, your sister was murdered, correct? It wasn't an accident, was it?"
"No, it was murder."
"Then why did you refer to it as her death just a moment ago?"
"I'm not sure."
"Are you confused about what happened to your sister?"
Maggie was on her feet objecting before Gleason could answer. "Counsel is badgering the witness," she said. "He's more interested in eliciting an emotional response than an answer."
"Your Honor, I am simply trying to learn how and why this witness views this crime the way she does. It goes to state of mind of the witness. I am not interested in eliciting anything other than an answer to the question I asked."
The judge weighed things for a moment before ruling.
"I'm going to allow it. The witness may answer the question."
"I'll repeat it," Royce said. "Miss Gleason, are you confused about what happened to your sister?"
During the exchange between lawyers and the judge, Gleason had found some resolve. She answered forcefully while hitting Royce with a hard stare of defiance.
"No, I'm not confused about what happened. I was there. She was kidnapped by your client, and after that I never saw her again. There is no confusion about that at all."
I wanted to stand up and clap. Instead, I just nodded to myself. It was a fine, fine answer. But Royce moved on, acting as though he had not been hit with the tomato.
"There have been times in your life when you were confused, however, correct?"
"About my sister and what happened and who took her? Never."
"I'm talking about times you were incarcerated in mental health facilities and the psych wards of jails and prisons."
Gleason lowered her head in full realization that she would not escape this trial without a full airing of the lost years of her life. I just had to hope she would respond in the way Maggie had told her to.
"After the murder of my sister, many things went wrong in my life," she said.
She then looked up directly at Royce as she continued.
"Yes, I spent some time in those kinds of places. I think, and my counselors agreed, that it was because of what happened to Melissa."
Good answer, I thought. She was fighting.
"We'll get back into that later on," Royce said. "But getting back to your sister, she was 12 at the time of her murder, correct?"
"That's right."
"This would have been the same age you were when your stepfather began to sexually abuse you. Am I right?"
about the same, yes? Did you warn your sister about him?
There was a long pause as Gleason considered her answer. This was because there was no good answer.
Ms. Gleason, the judge prompted, please answer the question.
No, I didn't warn her. I was afraid to.
Afraid of what?
Royce asked.
Him. As you've already pointed out, I've been through a lot of therapy in my life. I know that it is not unusual for a child to be unable to tell anyone. You get trapped in the behavior, trapped by fear. I've been told that many times.
In other words, you go along to get along.
Sort of, but that is a simplification. It was more...
But did you live with a lot of fear in your life back then?
Yes, I...
Did your stepfather tell you not to tell anyone about what he was doing to you?
Yes, he said...
Did he threaten you?
He said that if I told anyone, I would be taken away from my mother and sister. He said he would make sure that the state would think my mother knew about it, and they would consider her unfit. They would take Melissa and me away. Then we would get split up, because foster homes couldn't always take two at a time.
Did you believe him?
Yes, I was 12. I believed him.
And it scared you, didn't it?
Yes, I wanted to stay with my family.
Wasn't it that same fear and control that your stepfather had over you that made you go along to get along after he killed your sister? Again, Maggie jumped up to object, stating that the question was leading and assumed facts not in evidence. The judge agreed and sustained the objection. Undeterred, Royce went at Gleason relentlessly.
Isn't it true that you and your mother did and said exactly what your stepfather told you to in the cover-up of Melissa's murder?
No, that's not...
He told you to say it was a tow truck driver and that you were to pick one of the men the police brought to the house.
No, he didn't...
Objection!
There was no hide-and-seek game outside the house, was there?
Your sister was murdered inside the house by Kensington Landy. Isn't that true?
Your Honor!
Maggie was now shouting.
Counsel is badgering the witness with these leading questions. He doesn't want her answers. He just wants to deliver his lies to the jury.
The judge looked from Maggie to Royce.
All right, everyone, just calm down. The objection is sustained. Mr. Royce, ask the witness one question at a time and allow her the time to answer. And you will not ask leading questions. Need I remind you, you called her as a witness. If you wanted to lead her, you should have conducted a cross-examination when you had the opportunity.
Royce put on his best look of contrition. It must have been difficult.
I apologize for getting carried away, Your Honor, he said. It won't happen again.
It didn't matter if it happened again. Royce had already gotten his point across. His purpose was not to get an admission from Gleason. In fact, he expected none. His purpose was to get his alternate theory to the jury. In that, he was being very successful.
Okay, let's move on, Royce said. You mentioned earlier that you spent a considerable part of your adult life in counseling and drug rehab, not to mention incarceration. Is that correct?
To a point, Gleason said.
I have been clean and sober and a...
Just answer the question that was asked, Royce quickly interjected.
Objection, Maggie said. She is trying to answer the question he asked, but Mr. Royce doesn't like the full answer and is trying to cut her off.
Let her answer the question, Mr. Royce, Brightman said tiredly.
Go ahead, Miss Gleason.
I was just saying that I've been clean for 7 years and a productive member of society.
Thank you, Miss Gleason.
Royce then led her through a tragic and sordid history, literally going arrest by arrest and revealing all the details of the depravity Sarah wallowed in for so long. Maggie objected often, arguing that it had little to do with Sarah's identification of Jessup,
but Brightman allowed most of the questioning to continue. Finally, Royce wrapped up his examination by setting up his next witness.
Getting back to the rehabilitation center in North Hollywood, you were there for 5 months in 1999, correct?
I don't remember exactly when or for how long. You obviously have the records there.
But you do remember meeting another client named Edward Roman, known as Eddie.
Yes, I do.
And you got to know him well?
Yes.
How did you meet?
We were in group counseling together.
How would you describe the relationship you had with Eddie Roman back then?
Well, in counseling, we sort of realized that we knew some of the same people and liked doing the same things, meaning drugs. So we started hanging out, and it continued after we were both released.
Was this a romantic relationship?
Gleason laughed in a way that was not supposed to impart humor.
What passed for romance between two drug addicts, she said.
I think the term is enablers. By being together, we were enabling each other. But romance is not a word I would use. We had sex on occasion, when he was able to. But there was no romance, Mr. Royce.
But didn't you in fact believe at one point that you two were married?
Eddie set something up on the beach with a man he said was a minister, but it wasn't real. It wasn't legal.
But at the time you thought it was, didn't you?
Yes.
So were you in love with him?
No, I wasn't in love with him. I just thought he could protect me.
So you were married, or at least thought you were. Did you live together?
Yes.
Where?
In different motels in the valley.
All this time you lived together, you must have confided in Eddie, yes?
About some things, yes.
Did you ever confide in him about your sister's murder?
I'm sure I did. I didn't keep it a secret. I would have talked about it in group therapy in North Hollywood, and he was sitting right there.
Did you ever tell him that your stepfather killed your sister?
No, because that didn't happen.
So if Eddie Roman were to come to this courtroom and testify that you did indeed tell him that, then he would be lying.
Yes.
But you have already testified yesterday and today that you have lied to counselors and police. You have stolen and committed many crimes in your life. But you're not lying here. Is that what we are to believe?
I'm not lying. You were talking about a period in my life when I did those things. I don't deny that. I was human trash, okay? But I'm past that now, and have been past it for a long time. I'm not lying now.
Okay, Miss Gleason. No further questions. As Royce returned to his seat, Maggie and I put our heads together and whispered.
She held up really well, Maggie said. I think we should let it stand, and I'll just hit a couple high notes.
Sounds good.
Ms. McPherson, the judge prompted.
Maggie stood.
Yes, Your Honor. Just a few questions.
She went to the lectern with her trusty legal pad. She skipped the build-up and got right to the matters she wanted to cover.
Sarah, this man Eddie Roman and the phony marriage, whose idea was it to get married?
Eddie asked me to get married. He said we would work together as a team and share everything, that he would protect me, and that we could never be forced to testify against each other if we got arrested.
And what did working together as a team mean in that circumstance?
Well, he wanted me to sell myself, so we would have money to buy drugs and to have a motel room.
Did you do that for Eddie?
For a little bit of time, and then I got arrested.
Did Eddie bail you out?
No.
Did he come to court?
No.
Your record shows that you pleaded guilty to soliciting and were sentenced to time served. Is that correct?
Yes.
How long was that?
I think it was 13 days.
And was Eddie there waiting when you got out of jail?
No.
Did you ever see him again?
No, I didn't.
Maggie checked her notes, flipped up a couple pages, and found what she was looking for.
Okay, Sarah. You mentioned several times during your testimony earlier today that you did not remember specific dates and occurrences that Mr. Royce asked you about during the time you were a drug user. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, that's true.
During all of those years of drug abuse and counseling and incarceration, were you ever able to forget what happened to your sister Melissa?
No, never. I thought about it every day. I still do.
Were you ever able to forget about the man who crossed your front yard and grabbed your sister while you watched from the bushes?
No, never. I thought about him every day, and still do.
Have you ever had a moment of doubt about the man you identified as your sister's abductor?
No.
Maggie turned and pointedly looked at Jessup, who was looking down at a legal pad and writing what were probably meaningless notes. Her eyes held on him, and she waited. Just as Jessup looked up to see what was holding up the testimony, she asked her last question.
Never a single doubt, Sarah?
No, never.
Thank you, Sarah. No further questions.
Chapter 38. Thursday, April 8th, 10:35 a.m. The judge followed Sarah Gleason's testimony by announcing the mid-morning break. Bosch waited in his seat at the railing until Royce and Jessup got up and started to file out. He then stood and moved against the grain to get to his witness. As he passed by Jessup, he clapped him hard on the arm.
"I think your makeup's starting to run, Jason,"
he said it with a smile as he went by. Jessup stopped and turned and was about to respond to the taunt when Royce grabbed him by the other arm and kept him going. Bosch moved forward to collect Gleason from the witness stand. After parts of 2 days on the stand, she looked like she was both emotionally and physically drained, like she might need help just getting up from the chair.
"Sarah, you did great," he told her.
"Thank you. I couldn't tell if anybody believed me."
"They all did, Sarah. They all did."
He walked her back to the prosecution table, where Haller and McPherson had similar reviews of her testimony. McPherson got up out of her seat and hugged her.
"You stood up to Jessup, and you stood up for your sister," she said. "You can be proud of that for the rest of your life."
Gleason suddenly burst into tears and held her hand over her eyes. McPherson quickly pulled her back into the hug.
"I know, I know. You've held it together and stayed strong. It's okay to let it go now."
Bosch walked over to the jury box and grabbed the box of tissues. He brought them to Gleason, and she wiped away her tears.
"You're almost done," Haller said to her. "You've totally finished testifying, so now all we want you to do is sit in court and observe the trial. We want you to sit up here in the front row when Eddie Roman testifies. After that, we can put you on a plane home this afternoon."
"Okay, but why?"
"Because he's going to tell lies about you. And if he's going to do that, then he's going to have to tell them to your face."
"I don't think he's going to have a problem with that. He never did."
"Well, then the jury will want to see how you react, and how he'll react. And don't worry, we've got something else cooking that'll make Eddie feel some heat."
At that, Haller turned to Bosch. "You ready with this?"
"Just give me the sign."
"Can I ask something?" Gleason said.
"Sure," Haller said.
"What if I don't want to get on a plane today? What if I want to be here for the verdict, for my sister?"
"We would love that, Sarah," Maggie said. "You are welcome and can stay as long as you like."
Bosch stood in the hallway outside the courtroom. He had his phone out and was slowly typing a text to his daughter with one finger. His efforts were interrupted when he received a text. It was from Haller and was only one word: "Now." He put his phone away
and walked to the witness waiting room. Sonia Reyes was slumped in a chair with her head down, two empty coffee cups on the table in front of her.
"Okay, Sonia, rise and shine. We're going to do this. You okay? You ready?"
She looked up at him with tired eyes.
"That's too many questions, policeman."
"Okay, I'll settle for one. How are you feeling?"
"About how I look. You got any more of that stuff they gave me at the clinic?"
"That was it. But I'm going to have someone take you right back there as soon as we're finished here."
"Whatever you say, policeman. I don't think I've been up this early since the last time I was in county lockup."
"Yeah, well, it's not that early. Let's go."
He helped her up, and they headed toward Department 112. Reyes was what they called a silent witness. She wouldn't be testifying in the trial. She was in no condition to. But by walking her down the aisle and putting her in the front row, Bosch would make sure she would be noticed by Edward Roman. The hope was that she'd knock Roman off his game, maybe even make him change it up. They were banking on his not knowing the rules of evidence, and therefore not understanding that her appearance in the gallery precluded her from testifying at the trial and exposing his lies. Harry hit the door with a fist as he pushed it open, because he knew it would draw attention inside the court. He then ushered Reyes in and walked her down the aisle. Edward Roman was already on the stand, sworn in and testifying. He wore an ill-fitting suit borrowed from Royce's client closet and was clean-shaven with short, neat hair. He stumbled verbally when he saw Sonia in the courtroom.
"We had group counseling twice."
"Only twice?" Royce asked, unaware of the distraction in the aisle behind him.
"What?"
"You said you only had group counseling with Sarah Gleason twice."
"Nah, man. I meant twice a day."
Bosch escorted Reyes to a seat with a reserve sign on it. He then sat down next to her.
"And approximately, how long did this last?" Royce asked. "Each one was 50 minutes, I think," Roman answered, his eyes holding on Reyes in the audience.
"I mean, how long were you both in counseling? A month, a year, how long?"
"Oh, it was for 5 months."
"And did you become lovers while you were in the center?"
Roman lowered his eyes.
Yeah, that's right."
"How did you manage that? I assume there are rules against that."
"Well, if there's a will, there's always a way, you know? We found time. We found places."
"Did this relationship continue after you two were released from the center?"
"Yes. She got out a couple of weeks ahead of me. Then I got out and we hooked up."
"Did you live together?"
"Uh-huh."
"Is that a yes?"
"Yes. Can I ask a question?"
Royce paused. He hadn't expected this.
"No, Mr. Roman," the judge said. "You can't ask a question. You are a witness in these proceedings."
"But how can they bring her in here like that?"
"Who, Mr. Roman?"
Roman pointed out to the gallery and right at Reyes.
"Her!"
The judge looked at Reyes and then at Bosch sitting next to her. A deep look of suspicion crossed her face.
"I'm going to ask the jury to step back into the jury room for a few moments. This should not take long."
The jurors filed back into the jury room. The moment the last one in closed the door, the judge zeroed in on Bosch.
"Detective Bosch,"
Harry stood up.
"Who is the woman sitting to your left?"
"Your Honor," Haller said, "can I answer that question?"
"Please do."
"Detective Bosch is sitting with Sonia Reyes, who has agreed to help the prosecution as a witness consultant." The judge looked from Haller to Reyes and back to Haller.
"You want to run that by me again, Mr. Haller?"
"Judge, Ms. Reyes is acquainted with the witness.
Because the defense did not make Mr. Roman available to us prior to his testimony here, we have asked Ms. Reyes to give us advice on how to proceed with our cross-examination. Haller's explanation had done nothing to change the look of suspicion on Brightman's face.
Are you paying her for this advice?
We have agreed to help her get into a clinic.
I should hope so.
Your Honor, Royce said, may I be heard?
Go ahead, Mr. Royce.
I think it is quite obvious that the prosecution is attempting to intimidate Mr. Roman. This is a gangster move, Judge, not something I would expect to see from the district attorney's office.
Well, I strongly object to that characterization, Haller said. It is perfectly acceptable within the canon of courtroom procedure and ethics to hire and use consultants. Mr. Royce employed a jury consultant last week, and that was perfectly acceptable. But now that the prosecution has a consultant that he knows will help expose his witness as a liar and someone who preys on women, he objects. With all due respect, I would call that the gangster move.
Okay, we're not going to debate this now, Brightman said. I find that the prosecution is certainly within bounds in using Miss Reyes as a consultant. Let's bring the jury back.
Thank you, Judge, Haller said as he sat down. As the jurors filed back into the box, Haller turned and looked back at Bosch. He gave a slight nod, and Bosch knew that he was happy. The exchange with the judge could not have worked better in delivering a message to Roman. The message being that we know your game, and come our turn to ask the questions, so will the jury. Roman now had a choice. He could stick with the defense or start playing for the prosecution. Testimony continued once the jury was back in place. Royce quickly established through Roman that he and Sarah Gleason had a relationship that lasted nearly a year and involved the sharing of personal stories as well as drugs. But when it came to revealing those personal stories, Roman did a cut and run, leaving Royce hanging in the wind. Now, did there come a time when she spoke about her sister's murder?
A time? There were lots of times. She talked about it a lot, man.
And did she ever tell you in detail what she called the real story?
Yes, she did.
Can you tell the court what she told you? Roman hesitated and scratched his chin before answering. Bosch knew this was the moment that his work either paid off or went for naught.
She told me that they were playing hide-and-seek in the yard, and a guy came and grabbed her sister, and that she saw the whole thing.
Bosch's eyes made a circuit of the room. First he checked the jurors, and it seemed that even they had been expecting Roman to say something else. Then the prosecution table. He saw that McPherson had grabbed Haller by the back of his arm and was squeezing it. And lastly, Royce, who was now the one hesitating. He stood at the lectern looking down at his notes, one arm cocked with his fist on his hip like a frustrated teacher who could not draw the correct answer from a student.
That is the story you heard Sarah Gleason telling group counseling at the rehabilitation center, correct? He finally asked.
That's right.
But isn't it true that she told you a different version of events, what she called the real story, when you were in more private settings?
No. She pretty much stuck to the same story all the time.
Bosch saw McPherson squeeze Haller's arm again. This was the whole case, right here. Royce was like a man left behind in the water by a dive boat. He was treading water, but he was in the open sea, and it was only a matter of time before he went down. He tried to do what he could.
Now, Mr. Roman, on March 2nd of this year, did you not contact my office and offer your services as a witness for the defense?
I don't know about the date, but I called there, yeah.
And did you speak to my investigator, Karen Revell?
I spoke to a woman, but I can't remember her name. And didn't you tell her a story that is quite different from the one you just recounted?
But I wasn't under oath or nothing then.
That's right, sir. But you did tell Karen a different story, true?
I might have. I can't remember.
Didn't you tell Karen at that time that Miss Gleason had told you that her stepfather had killed her sister?
Holler was up with the objection, arguing that not only was Royce leading the witness, but that there was no foundation for the question and that counsel was trying to get testimony to the jury that the witness was not willing to give.
The judge sustained the objection.
Your Honor, Royce said, the defense would like to request a short break to confer with its witness.
Before Holler could object, the judge denied the request.
By this witness's own testimony this morning, you have had since March 2nd to prepare for this moment. We go to lunch in 35 minutes. You can confer with him then, Mr. Royce. Ask your next question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Royce looked down at his legal pad. From Bosch's angle, he could tell he was looking at a blank page.
Mr. Royce, the judge prompted.
Yes, Your Honor. Just rechecking a date.
Mr. Roman, why did you call my office on March 2nd?
Well, I had seen something about the case on the TV. In fact, it was you. I'd seen you talking about it. And I knew something about it from knowing Sarah like I did. So I called up to see if I was needed.
And then you came to my offices, correct?
Yeah, that's right. You sent that lady to pick me up.
And when you came to my office, you told me a different story than you are telling the jury now. Isn't that right?
Like I said, I don't remember exactly what I said then. I'm a drug addict, sir. I say a lot of things I don't remember and don't really mean. All I remember is that the woman who came said she'd put me up in a nicer hotel, and I had no money for a place at that time. So I sort of said what she told me to say.
Bosch made a fist and bounced it once on his thigh. This was an unmitigated disaster for the defense. He looked over at Jessup to see if he realized how badly things had just turned for him. And Jessup seemed to sense it. He turned and looked back at Bosch, his eyes dark with growing anger and realization. Bosch leaned forward and slowly raised a finger. He dragged it across his throat. Jessup turned away. Chapter 39. Thursday, April 8th, 11:30 a.m. I've had many good moments in court. I stood next to men at the moment they knew they were going free because of my good work. I've stood in the well in front of a jury and felt the tingle of truth and righteousness roll down my spine. And I have destroyed liars without mercy on the witness stand. These are the moments I live for in my professional life. But few of them measured up to the moment I watched Jason Jessup's defense unravel with the testimony of Edward Roman. As Roman crashed and burned on the stand, my ex-wife and prosecution partner squeezed my arm to the point of pain. She couldn't help it. She knew it, too. This was not something Royce was going to recover from. A key part of what was already going to be a fragile defense was crumbling before his eyes. It wasn't so much that his witness had pulled a 180 on him. It was the jury seeing a defense that was now obviously built upon a liar. The jury would not forgive this. It was over, and I believed everyone in the courtroom, from the judge to the gadflies in the back row of the gallery, knew it. Jessup was going down. I turned and looked back to share the moment with Bosch. After all, the silent witness maneuver had been his idea. And I caught him giving Jessup the throat slash, the internationally recognized sign that it was over. I looked back to the front of the court.
Mr. Royce, the judge said, are you continuing with this witness?
A moment, Your Honor,
Royce said. It was a valid question. Royce had few ways with which to go with Roman at this point. He could cut his losses and simply end the questioning. Or he could ask the judge to declare Roman to be a hostile witness, a move that was always professionally embarrassing when the hostile witness is one you called to the stand. But it was a move that would allow Royce more latitude in asking leading questions that explored what Roman had initially said to the defense investigator and why he was dissembling now. But this was fraught with danger, especially since this initial interview had not been recorded or documented in an effort to hide Roman during the discovery process.
"Mr. Royce," the judge barked, "I consider the court's time quite valuable. Please ask your next question, or I will turn the witness over to Mr. Haller for cross-examination."
Royce nodded to himself as he came to a decision.
"I'm sorry, Your Honor, but no further questions at this time."
Royce walked dejectedly back to his seat and a waiting client, who was visibly upset with the turnabout. I stood up and started moving to the lectern, even before the judge turned the witness over to me. "Mr. Roman," I said, "your testimony has been somewhat confusing to me, so let me get this straight. Are you telling this jury that Sarah Ann Gleason did or did not tell you that her stepfather murdered her sister?"
"She didn't. That's just what they wanted me to say."
"Who is they, sir?"
"The defense. The lady investigator and Royce."
"Besides a hotel room, were you to receive anything else if you testified to such a story today?"
"They just said they'd take care of me. That a lot of money was at—"
"Objection!" Royce yelled. He jumped to his feet. "Your Honor, the witness is clearly hostile and acting out a vindictive fantasy."
"He's your witness, Mr. Royce. He can answer the question. Go ahead, sir."
"They said there was a lot of money at stake and they would take care of me," Roman said.
It just kept getting better for me and worse for Jessup. But I had to make sure I didn't come off to the jury as gleeful or vindictive myself. I recalibrated and focused on what was important. "What was the story that Sarah told you all those years ago, Mr. Roman?"
"Like I said, that she was in the yard and she was hiding and she saw the guy who grabbed her sister."
"Did she ever tell you she identified the wrong man?"
"No."
"Did she ever tell you that the police told her who to identify?"
"No."
"Did she ever once tell you that the wrong man was charged with her sister's murder?"
"No."
"No further questions." I checked the clock as I returned to my seat. We still had 20 minutes before the lunch break. Rather than break early, the judge asked Royce to call his next witness. He called his investigator, Karen Ravel. I knew what he was doing, and I was going to be ready. Ravel was a mannish-looking woman who wore slacks and a sport jacket. She had ex-cop written all over her dour expression. After she was sworn in, Royce got right to the point, probably hoping to stem the flow of blood from his case before the jurors went to lunch.
"What do you do for a living, Miss Ravel?"
"I'm an investigator for the law firm of Royce and Associates."
"You work for me, correct?"
"That is correct."
"On March 2nd of this year, did you conduct a telephone interview with an individual named Edward Roman?"
"I did."
"What did he tell you in that call?"
I stood and objected. I asked the judge if I could discuss my objection at a sidebar conference.
"Come on up," she said.
Maggie and I followed Royce to the side of the bench. The judge told me to state my objection. "My first objection is that anything this witness states about a conversation with Roman is clearly hearsay and not allowed. But the larger objection is to Mr. Royce trying to impeach his own witness. He's going to use Ravel to impeach Roman, and you can't do that, Judge. It's damn near suborning perjury on Mr. Royce's part, because one of these two people is lying under oath, and he called them both."
I strongly object to Mr. Haller's last characterization, Royce said, leaning over the sidebar and moving in closer to the judge.
Suborning perjury. I have been practicing law for more than...
First of all, back up, Mr. Royce, you're in my space, Brightman said sternly. And second, you can save your self-serving objection for some other time. Mr. Haller is correct on all counts. If I allow this witness to continue her testimony, you are not only going to go into hearsay, but we will have a situation where one of your witnesses has lied under oath. You can't have it both ways, and you can't put a liar on the stand. So this is what we're going to do. You are going to get your investigator off the stand. Mr. Haller is going to make a motion to strike what little testimony she has already given, and I will agree to that motion. Then we're going to lunch. During that time, you and your client can get together and decide what to do next. But it's looking to me like your options got really limited in the last half hour. That's all.
She didn't wait for any of us to respond. She simply rolled her chair away from the sidebar. Royce followed the judge's advice and ended his questioning of Revell. I moved to strike, and that was that. A half hour later, I was sitting with Maggie and Sarah Gleason at a table at the Water Grill, the place where the case had started for me. We had decided to go high-end because we were celebrating what appeared to be the beginning of the end for Jason Jessup's case, and because the Water Grill was just across the street from Sarah's hotel. The only one missing at the table was Bosch, and he was on his way, after dropping our silent witness Sonia Reyes at the drug rehab facility at County USC Medical Center. Wow, I said after the three of us were seated. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that before in a courtroom.
Me neither, Maggie said.
Well, I've been in a few courtrooms, but I don't know enough to know what it all means, said Gleason.
It means the end is near, Maggie said.
It means the entire defense imploded, I added.
See, the defense's case was sort of simple. Stepfather killed the girl, and the family concocted a cover-up. They came up with the story about hide-and-seek and the man on the lawn to throw the authorities off of stepdad. Then sister, that's you, made a false identification of Jessup. Just sort of randomly set him up for a murder he did not commit.
But what about Melissa's hair in the tow truck? Gleason asked.
The defense claims it was planted, I said, either in conspiracy or independent of the family's cover-up. The police realized they didn't have much of a case. They had a 13-year-old girl's ID of a suspect and almost nothing else. So they took hair from the body or a hairbrush and planted it in the tow truck. After lunch, if Royce is foolish enough to continue this, he will present investigative chronology reports and time logs that will show Detective Kloster had enough access and time to make the plant in the tow truck before a search warrant was obtained and forensics opened the truck.
But that's crazy, Gleason said.
Maybe so, Maggie said. But that was their case, and Eddie Roman was the linchpin because he was supposed to testify that you told him your stepfather did it. He was supposed to plant the seed of doubt. That's all it takes, Sarah. One little doubt. Only he took one look at who was in the audience, namely Sonia Reyes, and thought he was in trouble. You see, Eddie did the same thing with Sonia as he did with you. Met her, got close, and turned her out to keep him in meth. When he saw her in court, he knew he was in trouble. Because he knew if Sonia got on the stand and told the same story about him as you did, then the jury would know what he was, a liar and predator, and wouldn't trust a single thing he said. He also had no idea what Sonia might have told us about crimes they committed together. So he decided up there that his best out was the truth, to screw the defense and make the prosecution happy. He changed his story.
Gleason nodded as she began to understand.
Do you think Mr. Royce really told him what to say and was going to pay him off for his lies?
Of course, Maggie said.
I don't know.
I said quickly. I've known Clive a long time. I don't think that's how he operates.
What? Maggie said. You think Eddie Roman just made it all up on his own?
No, but he spoke to the investigator before he ever got to Clive.
Plausible denial. You're just being charitable, Holler. They don't call him Clever Clive for no reason.
Sarah seemed to sense that she had pushed us into a zone of contention that had existed long before this trial. She tried to move us on.
Do you really think it's over? She asked.
I thought for a moment about it and then nodded. I think if I was Clever Clive, I'd be thinking of what's best for my client, and that would be not to let this go to a verdict. I'd start thinking about a deal. Maybe he'll even call during lunch.
I pulled my phone out and put it down on the table, as if being ready for Royce's call would make it happen.
Just as I did so, Boss showed up and took the seat next to Maggie. I grabbed my water glass and raised it to him.
Cheers, Harry. Smooth move today. I think Jessup's house of cards is falling down.
Bosch raised a water glass and clicked it off mine.
Royce was right, you know, he said. It was a gangster move. Saw it in one of the Godfather movies way back.
He then held his water glass up to the two women.
Anyway, cheers, he said. You two are the real stars. Great work yesterday and today.
We all clicked glasses, but Sarah hesitated.
What's wrong, Sarah? I asked. Don't tell me you're afraid of clicking glass.
I smiled, proud of my own humor.
It's nothing, she said. I think it's supposed to be bad luck to toast with water.
Well, I said, quickly recovering, it's going to take more than bad luck to change things now.
Bosch changed the subject.
What happens next? He asked.
I was just telling Sarah that I don't think this will go to a jury. Clive has to be thinking disposition. They really don't have any other choice.
Bosch turned serious.
I know there's money on the line, and your boss probably thinks that's the priority, he said. But this guy's got to go back to prison.
Absolutely, Maggie said.
Of course, I added. And after what happened this morning, we have all the leverage.
Jessup has to take what we offer, or we...
My phone started to buzz. The ID screen said unknown.
Speak of the devil, Maggie said.
I looked at Sarah. You might be on that plane home tonight after all. I opened the phone and said my name.
Mickey, District Attorney Williams here. How are you?
I shook my head at the others. It wasn't Royce.
I'm doing fine, Gabe. How are you?
My informality didn't seem to faze him.
I'm hearing good things out of court this morning.
His statement confirmed what I had thought all along. While Williams had never once shown his face in the courtroom, he had a plant in the gallery, watching.
Well, I hope so. I think we'll know more about which way this will go after lunch.
Are you considering a disposition?
Well, not yet. I haven't heard from opposing counsel, but I assume that we may soon enter into discussions. He's probably talking to his client about it right now. I would be if I were him.
Well, keep me in the loop on that before you sign off on anything.
I paused as I weighed this last statement. I saw Bosch put his hand inside his jacket and pull out his own phone to take a call.
Tell you what, Gabe, as independent counsel, I prefer to stay independent. I'll inform you of a disposition if and when I have an agreement.
I want to be part of that conversation, Williams insisted.
I saw some sort of darkness move into Bosch's eyes. Instinctively, I knew it was time to get off my call.
I'll get back to you on that, Mr. District Attorney. I've got another call coming in here. It could be Clive Royce.
I closed the phone just as Bosch closed his and started to stand up.
What is it? Maggie asked.
Bosch's face looked ashen.
There's been a shooting over at Royce's office. There's four on the floor over there.
Is Jessup one of them? I asked.
No. Jessup's gone.
Chapter 40. Thursday, April 8th, 1:05 p.m. Bosch drove, and McPherson insisted on riding with him. Holler had split off with Gleason to head back to court. Bosch pulled a card out of his wallet and got Lieutenant Stephen Wright's number off it. He handed the card and his phone to McPherson and told her to punch in the number. "It's ringing," she said. He took the phone and got it to his ear just as Wright answered.
"It's Bosch. Tell me your people are on Jessup."
"I wish."
"Damn it! What the hell happened? Why wasn't SIS on him?"
"Hold your horses, Bosch. We were on him. That's one of my people on the floor in Royce's office."
That hit like a punch. Bosch hadn't realized a cop was one of the victims. "Where are you?" he asked Wright.
"On my way there. I'm 3 minutes out."
"What do you know so far?"
"Not a hell of a lot. We had a light tail on him during court hours. You knew that. One team during court and full coverage before and after. Today they followed him from the courthouse to Royce's office at lunchtime. Jessup and Royce's team walked over. After they were in there a few minutes, my guys heard gunshots. They called it in and then went in. One was knocked down, the other pinned down. Jessup went out the back and my guy stayed to try CPR on his partner. He had to let Jessup go."
Bosch shook his head. The thought of his daughter pushed through everything. She was at school for the next 90 minutes. He felt that she would be safe, for now. "Who else was hit?" he asked.
"As far as I know," Wright said, "it was Royce and his investigator and then another lawyer, a female. They were lucky it was lunchtime. Everybody else in the office was gone."
Bosch didn't see much that was lucky about a quadruple murder and Jessup out there somewhere with a gun. Wright kept talking.
"I'm not going to shed a tear over a couple of defense lawyers, but my guy on the floor in there's got two little kids at home, Bosch. This is not a good goddamn thing at all."
Bosch turned onto First, and up ahead, he could see the flashing lights. Royce's office was in a storefront on a dead-end street that ran behind the Kyoto Grand Hotel on the edge of Japantown. Easy walking distance to the courthouse.
"Did you get Jessup's car out on a broadcast?"
"Yes, everybody has it. Somebody will see."